This is the No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this morning I'm joined by Mark Seaman, author, plural size author, and independent consultant. He's joining me from Copenhagen. Thank you, Mark.
Oh, thank you.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background, Mark?
I didn't really know that I was going to be anything with software or even computers when I grew up, because I'm that old. I'm from 1970, so lots of people actually were doing things about with computers when they were young, even though they were born at the same year that I was. But I didn't really realize that that was going to be the case. So I actually grew up and thought that I was going to do something else. But I was always pretty interested in technical stuff, and I thought that maybe I was going to be an engineer or something like that. But that really didn't pan out either. But then I found myself, starting to work with IT and things in the mid-90s. And I've been doing that since then. And I think I've been working specifically with software development since 1999. So I started out with on the Microsoft stack. And I think I started out with Visual Basic and C++, sort of a weird combination there. And then I went on to .NET when that came out. And I, spent lots of years, like 10 years, basically just doing C# and object-oriented development and thinking a lot about that and test-driven development. And then I discovered F#, I think it was back in 2010, and gradually started moving over to F# and finding that very interesting, until a couple of years ago I simply made the decision that the only reason that I will ever touch C# again is basically if someone pays me, which is not completely true, because I have a lot of open source projects that I started many years ago that are written in C# and I still maintain those. So I do occasionally still look at C# code, but these days my interests are mostly in what's happening in functional programming and how can I learn to be a better functional programmer, because that's a journey all by itself.
As an independent consultant, if I may ask, are you doing primarily F# now, or is that where you go back to C#?
No, well, that's where people pay me, and they usually pay me to do C#. So that's perfectly fine. I've been happy with C# for many years. I had lots of enjoyment with C#, and nowadays it's not so much an enjoyment anymore, because when you've done the same thing for 10 years, it's not really there. But it's not that I hate it at all. It's just it's not so fun that I actually do it voluntarily anymore. But I'm perfectly happy to write C# code for money.
We're going to talk mostly about functional programming, and I suppose a lot about F#. For a person who has never, let's say, heard of functional programming, and they're used to doing C#, what's the difference? What's it about?
So the main difference is probably that that functional programming, as the name implies, stems from the idea about thinking about functions. So it pretty much originates in mathematics, where people think about, a function is something that you give some sort of input and then you get an output out of that. And actually, functional programming was even defined before computers were defined, because it was defined with something called the lambda calculus back in the 30s as a, branch of mathematics. But it turned out that, when computers were invented, it was sort of interesting to start to thinking about how you can actually apply the lambda calculus in other ways to think about programming on computers, because that seemed to be something that was very well translatable into computers. And then it totally disappeared for many years, because the problem with functional programming is that in mathematics, values are not something that can change. There's no state in mathematics. A function is something that takes a value as input, returns a new value as output. So there's no side effects, and there are no changes of state. So every time you want to do something, if you want to manipulate a list, basically what you do is you have a list of values that you have as input, and then you get a list of values as output. And that's a different list. If you want to change something, you can't change the existing list. You need to make a copy and return that new value. And if you think about computers back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, that was obviously prohibitively expensive in terms of performance and memory footprints and so on. So basically, the idea about functional programming is very old, but it was not really something that was practically useful for many, many years, because it was simply, performance could only be absolutely horrible. But nowadays we have so powerful computers, and we also have this problem with, Moore's law that talks about, processors, the density of transistors grow at a particular rate, but we can't really make the transistors or the processors, you know, go faster. So instead, we are creating more processors. So now we have this problem that's about parallelism. And we need to think about that. And functional programming is very well suited for that sort of thing, because since everything is immutable and there's no state involved, you know, you can parallelize things and not really think about, you know, is this multi-threaded? Yes, it is, but it's, you know, you don't really have to worry about it because there's very little coordination involved in that. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why you know, interest has begun to grow of functional programming again. But then there are really other parts of functional programming that I find at least as attractive as just the amount about or the part about, you know, parallelism. But that's just a little bit of the story of it. But basically, the idea about functional programming is that, you know, everything is a function, and functions are also values. So you can compose functions into other functions. So you can say, well, I can actually, you know, define a function in terms of, you know, combining them with other functions. So also, so a little bit, you know, mathematical in the way that it originally originated, but very, very useful, it turns out. And one of the side effects of everything being functions is also that there's this emphasis on immutable values. So all values, or basically or most values, at least in functional programming, tend to be immutable. So we don't change state a lot. So instead, what we're trying to do is to make copies of values that, you know, are slight modifications of the input values. So that's really, you know, trying to give you, if you will, the essence of functional programming. Does that make sense, or was that too high level, too low level? Or?
No, not at all. But I might ask you a few questions to kind of help clear up a few things for myself. When you say no side effects, when I'm programming in my C sharp, typically I want my side effects. I want some incoming values. I want to work on them. I might want to save them to a database. I might want to write them to a file. I might want to do something else. Are we talking about two different things, or would you not be able to do that with F-sharp,
for example? No. So that's obviously, that's a perfectly good question that is probably the first one that comes to most people's minds. And we are talking about the same thing. And we do still want to produce side effects, even if we are doing functional programming, because otherwise, you know, everything that is observable is a side effect. So, you know, it wouldn't be interesting to do something that you can't even observe. You know, printing, you know, the results of your computation on the screen is also a side effect. So we need to have a way to do that. And so it's not that you can't have side effects at all in functional programming, but what often happens is that instead of saying that side effects are legal and possible all over your program, you tend to isolate this places where you have the side effects. And usually what you do is you push the side effects to the boundaries of your program. So you have a pretty large part of your code base, which is, you know, composed out of pure functions. And then you have at the boundary of your system that there you have where all the side effects occur. So that's where you may want to, you know, write a, you know, record into a database. So that's where you might want to delete a file or send an email or whatever it is. So we still want to do those things, but we just want to be able to have a little bit of discipline around, you know, where does that happen? Because it actually helps us to, you know, reason about the system that we have, that we know that, you know, there's a big piece in the middle of the, you know, the code base that is pure, and then we have the impure, you know, shell around that, if you will.
And would you write an impure shell in, for example, F-sharp, if you were doing the core of it in F-sharp?
So there's a little bit of a difference in, you know, between the languages and exactly how you approach this, because various functional programming languages have different degrees of discipline around this. And I think it's often a good idea to just start talking about Haskell, because Haskell is a pure, you know, functional programming language. It's also, you know, strongly typed. And so basically, if you know or if you understand how to do things in Haskell, you can always try to see how does that then apply to other languages. And in Haskell, you have this idea about something called I/O. And I/O is sort of a context. We might as well say the word monad, because we can't really avoid that. So it's a monad, but, you know, let's just call it a context for now. So I/O is basically just a context that denotes that whatever happens inside of that context is impure. That's where, you know, all the email sending and the record, you know, database record writing is happening. But then what you try to do in Haskell is you try to get out of that context as soon as possible, or basically saying, well, again, in the boundary of the system, the boundary of the system is composed or is happening within that monad, that IO monad. But then what's composed into that, you know, what actually defines the behavior of the application is just pure functions. So if you want to apply that sort of idea to other languages, you can definitely do that. So you can, you know, if you want to do this this type of programming in F#, for example, F# is not a strictly functional language. It's what we call a functional first language. It's running on .NET, so it's on, you know, on the common language runtime. So it has to be able to deal with and interoperate with whatever else is going on, you know, on .NET. So that's one of the reasons why it's impure. You can definitely do side effects wherever you want in F#, but the emphasis is on, you know, giving you good tools so that you would sort of fall into the pit of success of writing most of your F# code as pure functions. And then again, at the boundary of the system, you would have something that actually, you know, exposes all the side effects, if you will. But F# doesn't force you to do that in the same degree that Haskell forces you to do that. But you tend to arrive at the same sort of structure of code anyway.
No, sorry, go ahead, please.
Yeah, and I think as far as I can see, that's actually what's happening with lots of other functional programming languages. Maybe not all of them. You know, Erlang is a little bit different, but I'm not an expert there, though. But also one of the things that's a little bit interesting is that this actually corresponds pretty well to what we consider to be good object-oriented architecture. I don't know if you're familiar with an object-oriented architecture called ports and adapters. It's also sometimes named hexagonal architecture, and I think there's a variation of that called the onion architecture. But basically, it's I wrote this book called Dependency Injection in .NET a couple of years ago, and basically what I talk about there is how do you do dependency injection, which is sort of inversion of control. And if you apply this thing called the dependency inversion principle, which is one of the five solid principles, what you want to do is basically end up with a system where the core of the system, you know, your business model, your domain model is expressed in terms of the business logic itself, but it doesn't really depend on any sort of specific technology. So the domain model is expressed without any particular knowledge of what's your database technology look like, you know, what does your web technology look like, and so on. So you have this architecture where the pure, if you will, not in the mathematical sense, but the essence of what your application is doing is actually in the core, and then you have boundaries around that sort of communicates with the outside world, you know, that writes to databases or reads from databases or actually produces UI or whatever. So that's very closely related to the description that I just gave you about what does a Haskell program look like. We were saying, well, we have this core, which is the essence of the program, and then we have all the horrible stuff that needs to happen in order to actually modify the states of whatever system that you have. But the funny thing is that, you know, in object-oriented architecture, you have to write a 600-page book about that. You know, that's what I did. My book is almost 600 pages. And, you know, Robert C. Martin has written, you know, thick books about how do you do architecture and so on. So it doesn't come particularly natural in object-oriented design, but we've learned along the last 20, 25 years that if you want to have success with object-oriented design, that's the sort of architecture you would probably often tend to build. And the beautiful thing about functional programming is that instead of you having to spend 15 years learning all of that, you sort of just have to fall into that type of program structure, because that's the only thing that it, you know, particularly Haskell, that's the only thing it will allow you to do. So yeah, just to tie all of that back, I think it's very beautiful to think about.
Question on that though. When you say that Haskell ties you into doing a particular thing, does that mean Haskell is only appropriate for particular problems, that something like a C# would be much broader?
Right. Yeah. So that's also something that I often hear. there's this tendency to think about functional programming as something that is mostly interesting to people who are, you know, doing some work that's very closely related to mathematics or, you know, financial calculation, maybe. And F-sharp suffers from that misconception as well, because I think at one time when Microsoft started, you know, actually publishing Visual Studio with F-sharp as well, and people were asking Microsoft, you know, why do you need this F-sharp? And, you know, they said, well, you can do it if you have, you know, very computation intensive applications like financial calculation, science, and so on. And that sort of stuck. But really, these languages are Turing complete. They can do basically everything that C-sharp can do. And in my experience, anyway, is also that it not only can they do that, but once you learn how to think about how you would model, you know, your normal enterprise application and your normal blobber, you know, boring line of business application. I write a lot of those. But once you realize how you can model those things in F-sharp or in Haskell or whatever it is, it often turns out that you can actually, again, now you're starting to fall into that pit of success that the type system actually just gives you. It forces you, you know, functional programming forces you to think in terms of, you know, how do I make most of my application pure and easy to reason about? And then I have a little bit of the impurities at the boundary. So I'm basically at the point now where, you know, most of my, you know, my default language now, if people ask me to write almost anything, is just, you know, I fire up Visual Studio and then I, you know, select I want to have a new F-sharp project, and that's where I start. There are some edge cases where C-sharp may still be better, but that's mostly because a lot of the tooling in Visual Studio, for example, if you want to build, like, I think the most, maybe the most... maybe the best example of that is if you want to do something in ASP.NET MVC and you want to use the Razor syntax, you know, for creating views, the Razor syntax is built on top of, or, you know, composes C-sharp into it. And there's no way you can, you know, just replace that with F-sharp, because that's simply not what Razor does. So if that's the case, you would need to have some sort of a little bit of a, you know, 10% of your code sitting over there at the boundary of the system being C-sharp code, because that's what the tooling requires. But for most other things, I'm, you know, my default choice of language these days is F-sharp.
Actually, that leads us on very well to the next topic I wanted to bring up. Was you, from what you just said, it sounds like you think F-sharp or other functional programming languages would be perfectly acceptable to use in enterprise applications.
Sure.
Is the process the same? So, like, when I come along to an enterprise application, I think about, okay, I'm going to need probably a front end, be it web pages or a RESTful service. I'm going to need some sort of business logic to do lots of my processing, to accept, you know, beyond the basic incoming request, you know, get some information. I'm going to need some access to the database, or maybe to other services, and I'm going to need to isolate those from each other. I'm going to look at things like, oh, you know what? I'd like some dependency injection. I want some unit testing. I want, you know, lots of different things. Can you do all of that with F-sharp?
The short answer is yes, you can. You can do all of these things. But there's, you know, there are lots of different things that you mentioned there. So I don't know even where you want to start. But I think I'll pick one then. I'll talk about unit testing then, because I think that's very interesting. I've been doing test-driven development since I discovered test-driven development back in, I think it was 2003. And I've basically been doing it ever since. So that really has my interest. And one thing that I discovered after having, being doing a functional programming for a couple of years was that, you know, I found that, you know, testing my functions was really simple. And that was just an experience that I had. And then I started to think about, why is it that, you know, testing functions is always simple? And it wasn't until I listened to another podcast with Jessica Kerr, and she does a lot of functional programming, mostly in Clojure, I believe, maybe also in Scala. But she says, she defines, or she explains a function in the terms of something she calls isolation. And isolation is basically this principle where you say a function is isolated from its, you know, from its external world because it's pure. You know, pure function is something that doesn't have side effects. And the only thing that a function can work on is the input that is passed to it. Well, some of that input may be other functions, but that's a different story. But basically, that's all what a function does. It just acts on the input that it's given, and it doesn't have any implicit knowledge about the external world. You know, everything it knows is passed in through its input. But then if you look at what the definition of a unit test is, you know, that's a test that tests a unit in isolation of its dependencies. So now you have this thing where, you know, the word isolation appears on both in both definitions, and it's not even coincidental. This is actually the same type of isolation that we talk about. So it basically means that, you know, the ideal function is a pure function, and that means it's also just, you know, inherently testable by itself. Whereas, again, you know, in object-oriented design, we can make our things testable, but it's something that we have to work explicitly at making happen. Whereas in, you know, in functional programming, we just sort of by default fall into the pit of success in the sense, well, the correct way to design functional programming code base is also perfectly testable. So that's very beautiful, I think. I was so happy that when I actually discovered that, you know, relationship there.
To ask a question just about that, when I'm doing my unit testing, I often use a mocking framework like MLQ or RhinoMox, or let's take any NuGet packages out there. Sure. When I think about those, I'm thinking about those simply because I'm writing in C#. Are all those available for your F# program as well?
Well, you can do that in F# because F# just runs on top of on top of .NET. So you can use mock or you can use RhinoMox or whatever you want to use because they just work. And since F# also interoperates with the rest of the .NET framework, is you have the ability to still define or use interfaces or even abstract base classes if you want to do that. So essentially, they still compile into the same IL code, and you know mock MOQ just looks at the IL anyway, so it doesn't really care exactly which language it was written in anyway. So that will work perfectly well. Now that said, I also found myself not really using these tools in functional programming, and the reason for that is that interfaces in F#, for example, seems to me at least that they basically mostly exist in order to support interoperability with the rest of .NET. When you drop down into writing something that is more, you know, idiomatic functional programming in F#, what you tend to do is instead of using interfaces, you just compose functions of other functions. And a function is sort of a function is, you can think about it, you know C# already, so you can think about a function basically as a delegate, you know, a delegate in C#, you know, and the specific delegates like func of t and func of t1 and t2 and so on. So those are both basically functions as well. And you can think about a function or a delegate as it's sort of an anonymous interface that only has one method. But instead of having both to declare the interface, and you have to give the interface a name, and then you have to declare a single method on that interface and, you know, come up with a name for that, what you just say is, well, if it's always going to be just one interface with a single method on it, you don't really need to, you know, have to declare both of them, both the type and the method. You can just collapse all of that into one and then say, well, that's just a delegate instead. But it's just as polymorphic as an interface. You know, you probably know that from C#, is that you can say, well, if I have a function, if I have a method in C# that takes, you know, a func of t as input, you can pass anything into that, you know, argument that is a func of t. And that's where you start to compose functions with other functions. And that's just, instead of being something that is, well, it's actually pretty well done in C#, so I'm not trying to say that it's horrible in C#, but it's just, you know, F# just takes that idea of function composition to the next level and just makes it even more easy to compose functions of other functions than it is in C#. But basically, it's the same idea. But now we're looking at saying, instead of, you know, having to define a lot of interfaces and program against those interfaces, we just basically compose functions, you know, together instead of actually bothering with, you know, the overhead of having to define an interface, which you say, well, here's a function that's sort of like a func of t, but it's, you know, it has a little bit of a runtime. The runtime type is different.
That feels quite different, because something that as you progress in your software development skills, you begin to notice how useful an interface is, so that you could swap one implementation for another, or so that you could use mocking. I know that's not necessarily pertinent in your case, but that ability to you know, have a, like strategy pattern, two implementations or three implementations of a particular task. Is that something you can do with F-sharp, or is it something you just wouldn't do because you have a different way of doing it?
Well, but we still sort of do that thing, but it's just a, instead of using an interface, we're just using the strategy. So you talked about the strategy design pattern. And let's talk about the strategy design pattern in terms of we're passing in an interface. So that's basically what dependency injection is all about. You know, we inject an interface, and that interface is the strategy, and then we use the strategy from within the object that we are currently working with. So that's the object-oriented view of that. Now, what an interface can do in C# is that it can, you know, you can have a bundle of various methods defined on the same interface. So you could have an interface that had, you know, like a, you know, very common interface in object-oriented design is the repository interface that has, you know, create, read, update, and delete methods. So you have like I repository of T or whatever, and then it defines those four methods. As you know, that's the difference between interfaces and delegates, is that interfaces can bundle these things together. But then, you know, if you start to think about these solid principles, you know, the principles of object-oriented design that Robert C. Martin defined, you know, like 20 years ago, there's another principle there that's called the interface segregation principle that basically says, well, you should not force a client to depend on more members than it actually needs. So if you're passing in an I repository interface that defines, let's say, create, read, update, and delete, but you know your object is actually only using, you know, for example, the create method of that interface, you've sort of forced upon that object the three other methods that it doesn't need, and that's what the interface segregation principle says, is that you should not do that. And it, you know, it doesn't sound particularly bad when we're just talking about four methods, but so the principle was originally formulated in a context where there was a lot more, you know, than just four methods, you know. And I think the original example that Robert C. Martin, you know, that prompted him to think about this thing was like he had an interface that had like, you know, 50 methods or something like that. But if you really take the interface segregation principle to the logical conclusion, you keep on trying to trim it down, and in the end, you should arrive at, you know, where each interface has exactly one method. And once you arrive at that point, you know what you have is, you know, structurally equivalent to a delegate. You know, there's no difference between an interface with one method and then just a delegate like a func of T, or if it's a create method, maybe it's an action of T. And basically, that's what we say then when we do functional programming, is that we're saying, well, most of the time, not always, but like 90% of the time, you can model your domain in such a way that it consists of one method interfaces anyway. But once you've arrived at that point, you could do that in C# as well, and I do that a lot. But once you arrive at that point, you basically say, well, I don't really need interfaces anymore. I can just use functions instead. And so functions just become the unit of composition, whereas, you know, in object-oriented design, objects are the unit of composition. And in functional programming, well, functions are the unit of composition. But there's a lot of there's a lot of similarities there. It's a little bit of a different, you know, perspective of you know, how you look at things and what the languages, you know, make easy for you. But it's sort of the same thing that still goes on, you know, underneath the covers. You know, it's not a coincidence that you have a programming language like F# that is a functional programming language, but it still compiles to IL. You know, IL was originally defined. If you look at IL and what it's defined like, there's a lot of object-oriented thinking even in IL, because, you know, things like inheritance and so on is actually baked into, you know, intermediate language itself. And somehow we can still put something that is functional on top of that runtime, even though it was very object-oriented. It's not even just F#, you know, on the Java runtime, for example, in the JVM, they have two other functional languages over there. One is Scala and the other one is Clojure. And both of these are, if we will, functional first or, you know, multi-paradigmatic languages. But they still run on a runtime that was defined very much in the context of being object oriented. But somehow there are enough similarities, just a different perspective of things, that you can actually sort of map, you know, one way of doing it into the other one. That's also why you see a lot of functional programming languages can now, you know, they have compilers that can transpile them to JavaScript, for example. Not that I'm saying JavaScript is object oriented, but, you know, still. That was a long answer.
If you're developing, let's say, an enterprise application, and you have a choice between doing it in C# and F#, are there significantly different structures to the shape of your application? I don't know, the layers, the way you'd compose it between the two languages.
So when you say you mean
you,
me?
You, Mr. Mark Seaman.
Just not one, but actually me. Yeah, well, no, I probably would basically do it the same way, but the reason why I also use F# as my default language these days is because, you know, whenever I have to go back to C#, I'm sort of tainted by what I've learned from F#, and that means that I'm trying to apply all the ways to model things that I know of from F# in C#. And it's not that I can't do that. I perfectly know very well how to take most of the concepts from F# and apply them in C#. But it's just that it takes, there's a lot more work involved in doing it that way. And I think I've sort of forgotten how I used to do things like 10 years ago. So I would probably have done it very differently 10 years ago. But these days I'm so focused on this whole idea about, you know, immutability and, you know, the expressiveness of functions and the way that you can compose things, that I actually have a hard time, you know, thinking about it differently. I probably could, you know, I perfectly understand, you know, when I see code that other people have written that are much more object oriented. But it's just like my whole view of what object orientation is, what it is, has been so influenced by what I've seen that, you know, other paradigms can do, that I'm beginning to think about object orientation in these terms as well. So as I, you know, I just talked a bit before, like thinking about the solid principles, like, for example, the interface segregation principle, actually leads me towards a way where I say, well, this really begins to look a lot like functions, because, you know, the interface segregation principle's logical conclusion is that all interfaces should have, you know, exactly one method. And, you know, that's just me. Other people would arrive at different conclusions, but it's just that, you know, the way that I've begun to view object-oriented design now is sort of a thing that is quite closely related to functional programming. Not quite, but it's sort of in the same style, if you will. And other people have different, you know, approaches to what OOD is. And then everyone in the end has to quote Alan Kay in order to, you know, say that my definition is the correct definition of OOD. And fortunately, Alan Kay's original definition of OOD was so vague that everyone can say that, well, he actually meant this. And no one really knows what he actually meant. I think he's actually still alive, but, you know, we can still, it's much more fun to just quote Alan Kay from 1970 to actually go and ask him nowadays what he meant, I think. So I would pretty much, you know, write an F# application like I would write a C# application, but then I would probably write a C# application, you know, dramatically different from what most people do. But I've had people work on some of the C# applications that I've designed over the years, also in the last 3 or 4 years, and you know, I've met lots of C# developers that actually were happy with that. Once, you know, often what happened was that they were kind of looking at it a little bit askance and say, well, what is going on here? And they just needed a couple of days, and then they would sort of, you know, get into it, and then they'd, you know, they'd come back to me afterwards and say, this is actually, you know, I really hated it, you know, the first couple of days, but now I'm actually beginning to like it. Yeah, it's just a different way of thinking.
So we covered unit testing, and I'm probably going to guess your answer to this. With regard to deployment and things like DevOps, I imagine there isn't really any significant difference between any other .NET application.
Right. Yeah. A couple of years ago, for example, if you wanted to deploy an F# application to Azure, there was a little bit of a couple of you know, hoops you had to jump through, because some of the tooling back then actually, you know, assumed that you would have C sharp basically, but it's gotten better. So what I often see is that you can do, you know, basic Xcopy deployments, just like you would do if you could, you know, if you could write your C sharp code sufficiently Xcopyable, if you will, if that's a word. Yeah, so in the end, you know, it compiles down to IL, so that's actually pretty good. I must admit, though, that I'm a little bit concerned about the direction that ASP.NET is taking at the moment, because now it's actually being, it's leveraging Roslyn now, and that means that, you know, ASP.NET is beginning to be more tied into C sharp specifically. Although they do say that they have a story about how would you do this in visualbasic.net, for example. So they have some sort of, you know, a provider model or something where you can plug in different languages. And I think there are also people who have done some prototyping where you can say, well, take the ASP.NET core, I think the name is now, and you can then define a language provider for F sharp, and that should also work. But it's not really the mainline story there. So that does concern me a little bit, because it seems like they're actually, you know, coupling the implementation much more closely to the language than they ever had to do before. Because before, everything was just binaries that were compiled into IL, and, you know, the runtime really didn't care. So we'll see where that ends. But then again, there are lots of alternatives growing up, because the F sharp community is really gaining traction these years. So, you know, when I started with F sharp, there wasn't really a lot of F sharp specific tooling around. So basically, you just had to take whatever was in .NET already and try to work with that and create sort of, you know, translation layers if you needed those. But these days there are lots of different alternatives. So if you really want to have like a functional web server, you can go and pick one. There's one called Suave, which is a web framework written in F sharp that also, you know, can be hosted in IIS or any other sort of OWIN host. And you don't really need to, you know, even touch ASP.NET if you don't want to do that. I've mostly been, you know, doing ASP.NET work myself so far, but let's see where it goes. So there's going to be plenty of opportunities to keep you know using F sharp for the future, I suppose.
If a person wanted to get started in functional programming, is there some book you'd recommend that would be kind of the go-to first book?
Well, I can tell you which book that actually got me convinced that this thing was actually very interesting. And it's a book called Real World Functional Programming by Tomáš Petříček. He's from the Czech Republic, so, you know, not particularly easy to pronounce his name. But that's a book that was specifically designed to say, well, if you're already a C-sharp developer, here's this language, F-sharp, and it gives you lots of explanations, you know, with side-by-side examples saying, well, here's this concept in functional programming, and we can sort of, you know, model that with C-sharp, but then here's the F-sharp syntax. So again, you know, we talked about a little bit before how a lot of these things actually sort of corresponds. There's not a one-to-one correspondence, but there's, you know, like 80% of the concepts, you sort of have a corresponding model in C sharp as well. So this book teaches you, you know, it assumes that you already know C sharp, and then it teaches you F sharp, and it also teaches you not only the syntax of F sharp, but also the functional concepts along the way. And then when I was done with that book, I was just like, this is exactly, you know, everything just clicked for me, because I'd already been using Link for a couple of years, you know, language integrated query in C sharp. And I thought that was very nice, but it's sort of like it's just a language feature at that point to me. And then all of a sudden comes this thing along that says, well, you know, that concept with Link, that's something that has been, you know, in existence for, you know, as long as computers existed, and even more, this idea about doing maps and filters and so on lists. And it's like, oh, wow, that's actually the reason. And, you know, I just love when things click to me, and that book really just clicked for me. So I definitely recommend that for anyone who wants to learn F-sharp specifically, and particularly if you're coming from C-sharp. It's a wonderful book for that.
That's great. I always love seeing things like those cheat sheets showing you that if you've done something like an XUnit, here's how you do it in NUnit, and that kind of correspondence, so you can tie it back to how you used to think or how you currently think.
Yeah, Yeah, it does a pretty good job of that. You know, a little bit more than a cheat sheet. I think it's 400 pages, but.
Another question, just on, you mentioned how that gentleman's name is hard to pronounce, so I may mangle this. Your blog is Pleue?
Yeah, that's pretty close.
Pleue.dk.
Yeah.
I did a Google thing trying to translate Pleue, and it didn't come up.
Right, yeah. People sometimes ask me this, what does Pleue mean? So I can definitely, you know, reveal that it's pronounced Pleue. Pleue. But I'm not going to tell you. It's a secret.
So this is a word you made up.
No comment. I think I'll probably write down some sort of paper about what it actually means, and then I'll have to put it in escrow so that, you know, when I die, it will be revealed to the public.
30 years after your death, not immediately. Any final notes, Mark, before we wrap up?
Not really, you know, as you probably noticed, you know, I can just keep talking about all sorts of stuff for hours, but you also have a schedule and the listener probably wants to get on with their lives. So I think I think this is as good as a place as any other place to stop. Yeah.
Do you have any Pluralsight courses on functional?
Oh yeah, thanks for asking. Yes, I do. I have 5 Pluralsight courses on specifically about F-sharp, various things in F-sharp, something about architecture, and then I have a like 3 or 4 courses that mostly teach you how to do testing, also something called property-based testing with F-sharp. So there was a time where I had I think I had 60% of all F-sharp content on Pluralsight. I think it's getting a little bit better now that there are actually more people doing F-sharp courses on Pluralsight. Yeah, but I definitely have those. And they're good, I think, so I would definitely recommend people to check them out.
Well, thank you very much for your time today, Mark Seaman.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The opening music was Return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was By the Coast 2004 by Anthony Rejekov from the album Jazz U.